So, welcome to the last of compiler construction today. We started with the final part of the lecture, part of code generation, last time, and we introduced the first few basic concepts of the underlying hardware that we target from our intermediate representation. This would be a simplified abstract virtual machine here that bears a lot of resemblance with the typical assembler languages that are out there for different architectures, but still needs to be translated with one step further to the respective concrete assembly architecture that you're actually really targeting in the end, but it is already so close to what you really want to have that this should be not a large problem. So what we have focused on is the expression translation last time, and for that we introduced the concept of unlimited registers that could be addressed by the expression interpretation or expression evaluation procedures via some index of registers, and we figured out a particular pattern of how to use indices such that you could keep intermediate results of expression evaluations in a subset of the registers while wildly rewriting everything that is, not in this safe area by just incrementing the index of last register in or highest register in use and just go wild on everything that is beyond that. With that, we have established a concept for evaluating expressions and have gone over to the first statements. So we have learned about how to generate manipulation of control flow with conditional jumps and have even had a look at the first loop construction here with the while loop, and that's where we're going to continue today. So there is this example translation of loops, and we have a while loop to translate here with a particular program environment that we are given here. So these are the indices in the local registers that we intend to use whenever we want to access the values for A, B, and C. And then there is the actual program that we plan to translate. So there's several parts to that. There is the part of the actual loop condition and the control fork. So there is this part here, which is translated over there at the bottom, with the actual comparison being tackled at first. So this comprises accessing the value of A, which we can look up here in the environment. This is kept at register 7, so this will be translated to a move from register 7 to the current free register. We need also to load some constant value into another register and then perform the actual comparison operator, that thing. And this now gives us the chance to branch depending on whether the condition was fulfilled or not, with the following jump 0 to a particular label B, which points to the end of the current instruction sequence. So that is usually the case when this RI now evaluates to 0 whenever we leave the loop. So in case that we stay in there, we will just fall through and go over to interpret these two assignments of some simple expressions. So these things boil down to two moves into the registers for C and A, which would be C goes to 9, B goes to 8. So oh, not C and, C and B, but C and A. So it goes to 9 and 7, and this is what you see here. They go to 9 and 7. And apart from that, it's just, well, oh, for once there is the addition, there is the subtraction, and everything else is just the usual move and load constant. So nothing surprising here, and both of them belong to the actual body of the loop. And then there is still the fact that at the end of the loop we need to jump back to the beginning of the loop, and this is achieved with this jump over here that goes back to the beginning, where the same code as initially already used for evaluating the loop condition is again performed, and this thing goes on. So that is kind of that. Good. So what else can we expect at the in this area? So there's other notions of loops, for example these for loops, which are essentially, well, can be seen as a particular kind of specialization of the while loop, with a few modifications. For loops, you can just reuse the pattern for while loops, especially if you look here, you see that it's just like that the first expression is used as a preceding statement for initialization. Then there is the actual while loop happening with a condition from the middle, and then in the end, this E3 is increment statement that is added at the end of the loop. In that sense, you can just rewrite this whole for loop pattern into a while loop, and the actual code that is created for that reflects that quite directly. So, yeah, there is the first part where there is the initial statement for initialization purposes usually. So this goes here. Then we have the while loop condition evaluation. This goes here together with the according jump in case that the loop condition is not met, and this goes to the end of the loop. And well, then there is still the actual loop body, this S prime, which is just in our case it's called S down here. I don't know why it's S prime over there. Well, this goes just here, and then there is the E3 part from the for loop, which is just found over here before we have the jump back to the beginning of the loop condition. So this is not all too surprising. Another thing that manipulates the control flow in typical programs, in C programs, is the switch statement. So there you have a variable based on, or an expression based on the evaluation of said expression. You would then continue executing at particular cases that you can declare for such a switch statement, and then depending on whether the switch statement is closed with a break or not, you would continue either jumping out of the switch statement or continuing with the next case. So what would be particularly handy there would be, well, in principle we could already translate that with the means that we have by misusing the usual if branch statement to encode ladders of if branches that in the end also lead to the cases that we define in switch statements. However, this is This means that there is a lot of comparisons along the way to the actual cases. There is always this idealistic concept of switch statements that comes to mind when you talk about those, where the cases for the switch statements are all just one unit apart from each other, so that you have kind of a very dense field of cases in terms of values that the expression in question can evaluate to. And if that is the case, you can try to come up with a more performant implementation of a switch statement, with the idea in mind that you can just use an indirection by the actual value of the expression in question to choose between the several cases that you declared in just constant time, in a similar manner as you could, for example, access arrays. And the idea is the same as in arrays. You establish some kind of a table that has a well-known base address and interpret the accessing expression as just an offset to this starting address, and then interpret whatever you find there. And in terms of, well, having to encode a case statement, you could then, in each of the jump table's entries, just place an actual direct jump instruction that would dispatch control to the handler for the particular case. So how would something like that work? Well, first of all, you need an instruction that supports this notion of indirect jumping, which we introduce here with this jump indirect, jump E, that gets as parameters the register base which carries the value on which we want to perform this indirect jump, together with the start address of the jump table. So there is A, which is the address of the jump table, and RI, which is the just holding the value that determines which alternative is jumped to. And what that does is this will, whenever the interpreter encounters this combination, what it will do is it will place both things into the sum of both things into the program counter. So A is added to Q and put into the program counter, so that the next instruction will be the one found at A plus Q. So far, so simple. Let's have a look at how that can be used for a code generation scheme for a switch case statement. So the switch case statement that we look at here is one of those that has this idealistic structure of having consecutive case alternatives. So this goes from 0 to some k minus 1, so k many alternatives. They are all consecutive. There's consecutives. There's no holes in there. There is also the break statement after each of the cases, so that we can safely exit the case distinction afterwards and continue with whatever statement comes behind. And then there's also the default case for everything else. And all of those come with an appropriate statement, which might, of course, be a statement sequence, so this doesn't necessarily need to be just one statement, that encodes the actual handler for the case triggered by the evaluation of the expression from E. Okay, so how this is already quite idealistic. I said this is consecutive alternatives. There's no clustering going on or anything like that. There's breaks everywhere, but these are kind of limitations that are there for presentation purposes. If you do actual practical code generation for switch statements. This can be easily lifted to a code generation scheme that also deals with these corner cases like missing break statements or gaps in the case definitions and all that. But let's maybe first have a look at the way that we define code for that. So there is the code generation, starting with the actual evaluation of the expression in question. So E, of course, needs to be evaluated. That's going to be done with the by now well-known interpretation routine code E, a code of E, and the resulting value will be found in register RI. Then there is some mystery function that follows here, which is this check of, well, whatever we see here. We will discuss that a little bit later. I can just indicate now that this is the one that will do boundaries check for boundaries checks for the value that comes out of that. So this will be something like encoding this one and based on that dispatch a little bit differently than you would ordinarily do. But you can just ignore that for now. What else you find in this code generation scheme is this third parameter for check, which is this B thing. This gives you the starting address of the actual jump table. So this is a this is considered to be a table found in the code store of the machine, and this is considered to be the actual table in there, with entries from A0 to A, entries from 0 to K here that contain the actual jump table in form of jump instructions to well-known labels A0 to AK, and they are in fact then dispatching to the cases that you see defined over there. What are these cases? These are cases that correspond directly to the handler statements for each of those cases. So we perform code generation for the statement as 0, and then jump to some location. Repeat that until we reach the code generation for the last statement as k, and then also jump to this well-known location. This jump to the well-known location corresponds to the breaks that we find here. These are the same things as these jump C's, as they will jump to a label that leads to the end of the current instruction sequence, and this just exits the switch statement by just jumping to the end of everything. So, so far, we have seen these parts. The only thing that we haven't seen yet is the actual part that performs the indirect jump to the handler methods in terms of reaching the correct cell in the jump table. Well, that's because this is hidden in this mystery check function. And so this is what this does. This check function checks whether the lower and the upper bound contain the value of RI and jump accordingly, it says here. So this check macro expands to a particular code like the one here, where there are several components to this. There is, of course, well, there's these boundary checks that consist in these sequences of loads and compares and jumps. And they are comparing based on this lower and upper value. And yeah, they jump to the labels E and D. So let's maybe focus on them. So E goes here, and D goes there. So the D label is the one where everything went according to plan. So RI is actually between the lower and the upper bound of the of the cases that we offer. So in that case, we can safely perform the actual indexed access to the jump table by inserting the recently introduced indexed jump, and this jumps to this RI that is carried through the whole instruction sequence here from the beginning. So this contains the value based on which we do the actual dispatching. This then goes to the right slot within the jump table. E is the label that is used for reaching the case for, well, whenever something goes wrong, which would be the something goes wrong within the boundaries check. So this is then usually the default case. So let's have a look at what that does. No, not like this. Like this. So at the label E, what is happening is that RI will be filled with, well, the difference between U and L, which usually should be K. So this is the Kth case. So this directly dispatches to this fellow over here, which is when we look back to our original cogeneration scheme. This is the case for the default handler. So yeah, that's that. Okay, so this is kind of the basic version of what the switch case will boil down to. However, there are certain optimizations possible, and usually whenever you don't do just a dumb code generation, but one that does actually optimize a little bit either on the way of code generation or a little bit after, then you will look out for certain things to optimize from that, particularly these tests for lower and upper bound. These constraint checks will be typical candidates for removal in case that you can prove that the removal for that does no harm. So if you have some kind of guarantee that there is the the value will always evaluate to a value within the interval between L and U, then there is no actual need for a runtime check whether the whole thing evaluates in this interval. So you can then just omit the constraint checks in the macro check and instead do a direct indexed jump in order to reach the jump destination target. The other thing is that, well, the pattern that you have seen in the slide before is the one that works with general values for lower and upper bound. I don't know. I think this should be the lower bound, not the upper bound here. So in case that the states do actually start with zero, then there's no need for normalization of the value. So in this case, we can directly add the value that we obtained from evaluating E to the base address of the jump table and use it directly as an index. So there's also this normalization of the index value that can be removed. So there's a lot of room for improvements with that. Also, this is the generation for a very limited case, particularly the one where we have one case following the other with just no gaps in there. In general, you will find code generation of switch statements where there is usually some kind of combination between the if ladders and the indirect jump approach. And, well, this is a matter for heuristics, and there is a lot of fine-tuning going on in practical switch case statements. So, it depends on the actual size of the gaps, whether it makes sense to, for example, keep a few of the entries of the jump table just invalid and never used, just defaulting to the default handler, for example, and whether it actually makes sense to introduce these if ladders as guards before we actually reach table-based dispatching. But, well, this is a matter of optimizing and profiling and so on. And it's difficult to say what the optimal approach to that actually is. But well, just so that you know there is not a one right way to do that. You could either tend to use these if ladders, or you could use these others or combine them. It depends on the application. So much for the actual intra-procedural control flow manipulating statements. The next big topic in code generation is procedure calls or function calls. So this now leaves the area where we just dispatch control within one body of a function, but now dispatch control between several functions. So what are the components of functions that are interesting for that? Well, usually you need some reference to a function which you want to call, and well, here it says a name with which it can be called. Of course, there could also be some function pointer or something like that. So there is some kind of reference of what to call. So, well, this usually boils down to some kind of address where the system can find the function to be called, and this, for our purposes, is depicted with such a label in there. So, yeah, what else is there? There's a specification of the formal parameters of a function. So this is the list of parameters that you find in brackets after the name of the function. There's also usually some kind of result type or void, which is also a type in that sense. And then there is the function body, which consists of a sequence of statements that is assumed to be the body of the function. So, if you, in terms of semantics, what functions actually mean is, well, should maybe look at an example here. This is program with a main routine that, as an example, issues two calls to this function over here. So there is the factorial function of 2 and the factorial function of 1 called here. This both of them refer to the same function. However, when they are called, they have to work with different parameters. So there is a need of separating those two instances from each other in terms of access to variables, for example. Also, if you look closer to that, the function will, in general at least, at some point call another factorial function, or will call factorial again, so it can call itself recursively. And in that case, well, the interpretation of the, or the execution of the factorial function is not yet terminated, since there usually is still a part of the expression left to be evaluated. However, we already have to somehow execute the factorial function once again. So in our scheme of translating accesses to parameters and local and variables and whatnot, we usually have a fixed scheme of doing that. Remember, there is this way of analyzing declarations and uses of variable names, and this determines fixed numbers that are used as indices for registers where we find the actual values of the function. So if we have several instances, so to say, of the factorial function being active at the same time, with active meaning that within the call stack of a function, namely this, for this main function, we have possibly at least several calls to the factorial function that are opened until at some point one of them terminates without recursively calling itself, and only then this whole stack is then destroyed again. So in that sense, we have to keep open a few instances of the management structures for the factorial function. So how do we do that without destroying the values that we have left when we started each instance of the factorial function, while we already have to reuse the same registers for the new instance of the factorial? Well, this is what the memory management for functions is all about. So what we have to remember is we have to keep apart formal parameters and local variables for each of the various instances of a function. So they have to be separated from each other. How can we do that? Well, good question. The numbering scheme for each of the registers is a thing that we have fixed beforehand while analyzing the identifiers of each of the functions. What else can we use for keeping values? Well, there's still the idea of having an actual memory for values, the usual store that we use for setting up such a virtual machine. And there's also the notion of, well, if we have something like this chain of method calls that are nested into each other, they usually access their management structures in a kind of, well, LIFO structure in that sense. So the last function that somehow has established that it wants to use them, those variables will be also the will be also accessing them until it is terminated, and then only the next one is back in charge again. So this already is these nesting structures already smell a lot like a stack that is to be used. So in that sense, the organization of these management state cells will probably have to do something with a stack, and this is also what is done here. So each of the functions that is active at a point has a particular area on the stack that is assigned to that function only, and this function can use the memory in its stack area, which is called the stack frame of a particular instance of a function. And let's have a look at the way that stack frame is organized. So usually you have a few management cells on the stack that are keeping book of a few a few values that are stored away for later use. Particularly what you find there is usually values of important registers, like the program counter, the old stack pointer, or the frame pointer of the former active function that has called the new function here. And these values have been backed up into this stack frame for the case when the execution of the current function terminates. Then these values usually are restored back into their system registers for just continuing where the old function has left off. The area below is usually off limits for access of the current function. This is the place where the function instances that have been formally executed and have called their respective callee store their management data. So this should not be accessed in any way. Instead, what you have to work with is the space directly above the organizational cells. Here you can just put anything that you want to associate with this particular instance of a function, and the area in which you can do that is managed by the pointers of by the stack pointer and the frame pointer, and the area in between that is the one that you can use for storing information that you need to keep at some point exclusive to you. So this is now a good space where we can just store away everything that is in danger of being overwritten. And this is what actually will be the case whenever we transfer control to a new function. There we there's danger that my local variables, as well as parameters and what else we have created so far, is overwritten, so we will usually store that away. So let's maybe focus back to what actually really happens at the function call. So for the purpose of that, we will introduce a few names, particularly when in the situation of function f calling a function g, then we will call the function f the so-called caller, and the function g the callee. So these will be the terms that we use to differentiate between them. So what happens usually during a function call is that first of all the reference to whatever function is called needs to be computed. This works by evaluating some expression that is part of the function call expression. So this will compute the start address of the callee G. Then what will be done is the actual parameters that for the function will have to be communicated to the callee. This is what the globals are actually for. Parts of the globals are reserved for communicating parameters from callers to callees. So this will be part two of the code generation. Then following that, we already aim for transferring control to the callee. And this will mean that the local variables that are located in the local registers will almost immediately be overwritten by the callee. So we have to do something to prevent losing all this data. So what usually happens is we will do a backup of these registers onto the stack, in the stack frame that we have established a little bit earlier. So this is what step three is about. Step four and five and six will consist of manipulating the management registers such that we establish a new function frame for the callee, as well as setting the continuation address in the program counter, and then control will switch over to G, where G will then immediately start pulling all the actual parameter values from the globals into its own locals, thus overwriting the values that are stored in the locals from the instance before. So everything from step one to step six is things that you will find that will be done by F itself. Only step seven will be found in the callee itself. So whenever then the function leaves the callee at the end of the function call, there's also steps that are done by the callee and steps that are done by the caller. So, well, there is usually some kind... Yes?
So in this definition of program for translation, you would always pass the parameters to the globals, not to the registers.
Pass the...
You say,
the globals in that sense, but there's the globals are in that sense also registers, aren't they? The thing is that you need some well-known place because you as a callee you never know where in the locals you would actually really find this thing. You could maybe do some optimization or some other concept where you just give an index to the callee, which gives you the lowest register in the locals where you can find the sequence of actual parameters. That could also work, but then you still would have to somehow rearrange everything such that the you re-establish some common naming, so there will also be a copying phase there. So why not just use the globals anyway? Okay. Yeah, so usually you have some kind of return value, so you compute that and store that into R0, and then just restore the old management registers like frame pointer, stack pointer, and so on, and then just set the PC to the point where the call site in F was, and this is a thing that has been backed up by the caller already in step 6 of the process of actually entering the callee. So this is just a restoration of the PC, and after that, control is back to the caller, where this will immediately restore its own local variables from its stack with this restore locals instruction. So let's have a look at how that works probably. So yeah, there is the once again a kind of a reminder of what the layout of the registers looks like, in the sense of what purpose do they serve. So the automatic variables, automatic they are termed here, but this is what the local variables actually really is. So the local variables live in the local registers, of course. The intermediate results are also in the local registers. However, usually, depending on your nesting of the actual function call, you might as well be in a situation where you actually really have intermediate results at the time of calling a particular function. So there might even be intermediate results currently in the local registers when you do such a function call, whereas the parameters of a function are usually living in the global registers as well as the return value. And global variables, well, for our purposes, we ignore them here for just purposes of presentation here, but it would actually make no big effort to really keep global variables around. This just changes a little bit the index where you start using the globals for putting parameters in. So you would reserve space for the global variables at the very beginning, where you scan through your program body and extract all the global variables, and then just reserve space for that in the beginning, and then don't start at register R0, but at the register for the global variables. But yeah, for our purposes, there is just no global variables here. For passing parameters between functions, we can then say that the ith argument of a function is passed in the register R minus I. The result of a function is usually communicated via R0, and well, local registers don't play a big role in communicating information. Instead, they are just backed up into the stack frame and will be overwritten at the beginning of a function. So this is not so important here. Then how does a translation of function calls really look like? We said the first step is usually to evaluate the expression that determines the actual function to be called. So this is what this G is all about, and this leads to just an evaluation of expression G, which is then usually boiling down to be some label or address of a function, which is then followed by the parameters. So they are evaluated. They can be complex expressions, so they need to be evaluated also. So this is going on right here. But what then happens is that we find these values now in the registers starting from Ri and ending in Ri plus n. So what then needs to happen is we need to put them into places where they can be picked up by the callee in a meaningful way, and this is what is given with these move instructions, where we move the resulting values to the parameter registers R minus 1 to R minus n. Then we continue with backing up everything that we have worthwhile to store into the stack. So this is what this instruction save locals is all about. So we save everything from register 1 to register RI minus 1. So this is every register up to the computation of the actual function G, and then perform mark and call, which is there to back up the management registers and put the program counter's value also in the frame, in the function frame, and exchange the copy the continuation address, the address of the callee into the program counter. So at that point, then, usually there is the control is given away from the caller to the callee. So this restore log is not directly executed right now, but only after the callee returns, then the execution will be restarted over here, where we immediately do restore of the locals. So the locals from R1 to RI minus 1 are re-established and loaded from the function frame, and then only the we have to make sure that the value that was computed by the function can be found again, and this will be found in register RI. So this is the part that the caller has to do, and all of that together is the code that is generated for this one simple call expression. Yeah, this is just what the instructions do. Yeah, so there's this mark instruction. This will just allocate the stack space for the organizational cells and backs up the frame pointer. I think this is the return value thing is left over from some earlier thing. This is not happening here. Then the call instruction is the one that backs up the continuation address after the function call. This can be obtained from the current program counter, and if you increment that, this will be the continuation address after the call is done. This will be put onto the stack, and frame pointer and program counter will be set according to what the current stack pointer is, as well as what address is given to the call as the continuation address. So this ends up in the program counter. Yeah. So this goes in there. The result of a function, in order to communicate that, we have to hook into the way that the return statement works. So this usually has this keyword return and some expression behind that. So for that, usually we have to evaluate the expression that is given to us. We will find the resulting value in RI, and then we have to transport that into its rightful place in R0 with this last move, and then we just call the return. And if there is just no expression returned because it's a void function, then this just contains a return. So, yeah, the global registers themselves are not used inside a function body because we have copied them into the locals already. Why is that? Well, we usually have to do something like that in order to be able to do calls from the Cauchy again, because then we would have to override the values that are currently residing in the globals, because we will do another method call. So in order to be able to reuse them immediately, we will just copy them into locals. So the globals themselves are not to be used within the function itself. The return instruction will just transfer control back to the caller by restoring program counter and frame pointer according to the values that are stored within the function's frame itself in the management part where the organizational cells are backed up. So the code generation for function declaration or specification rather looks the following way. So there is the function name itself with some arguments and declarations part and actual statement sequence in there, and there's a some return type there. And well, how that is interpreted as code is that first of all there is the part where we make sure that we get a grasp on the parameters, the actual parameter values that are given to us in locals. So this is where we find them, and this is the place where we keep them in our locals. Then we will do the actual code generation for the statements, with the first free register being computed from the number of locals that comes by the number L, and the number of parameters that comes from the number N, and well, one more for the first cell that is free, and then we have a return in the end in case that, well, the function body terminates without any actual real return statement being there. So function is assumed to have N parameters and L local variables, and the parameters are kept in R minus 1 to R minus N, of course. Yeah. And the only influence that the declaration has is that this determines how the environment mapping actually really looks like, but this is a thing that is usually done by the symbol table visitor anyway, so this is not the focus here. Yeah, the return there is a thing that might not be always necessary, but in case that there is no actual real explicit return instruction in the statement sequence, we still keep it there. And if it's unreachable, well, doesn't matter. And if it is reachable, then it's better that we have it there. Otherwise, we would have non-deterministic behavior. The question would be, here is, well, are these move instructions from that part here always really necessary? Could you not just directly compute with the values of the parameter registers? This is a thing that we have kind of implicitly already talked about a little earlier. This would be, well, would be possible in case that the statement list doesn't contain any other procedure call. If we can certify that, then we could probably live without without having these move instructions there, and we would have to fiddle around a little bit with the environment so that this points to the global registers instead of the locals. But yeah, this all depends on whether the function calls any other function or not.
Why is that a problem? I mean, as long as you keep the caller set registers untouched, and parameter registers don't necessarily need to be
Well, in case that you, after you issue the call within F, so you have your F implementation starting there, and in the middle you call another G, and you access parameter P here and here. Here you get the original value that was given to you as your actual parameter value. Here you have reused the parameters in order to communicate parameters to G. But, well, you...
You
would have to back them up, save local to the stack at some point, and then this would have worked.
I think that's what usually, if you compile it with GCC at least, would happen. So, but this would of course require a neck over the logic or something.
You would have to at some point just make sure that the globals also go onto the stack. This would, in that case you could do that, but you would have to manipulate the generation schemes that we have seen so far. Yeah, you could, of course. Yeah, there's a lot of optimizations that you can do there. Yeah. Okay. So. Yeah. Then, what else is there that we need to do? Well, we will probably have to have some kind of entry point into this whole clutter of code that we have generated, or that we have provided generation schemes for. So, what do you have to come up with some convention of where you enter execution, and for usual console programs, this would mean that you would have to specify some kind of main function. So, this is usually what happens in standard C programs. So, this is because, the executable would then be provided in the following form, where you immediately just load the address of main into R1 and and act as if there would be a method call. So you would do a mark and call. In case that you have actual real interaction with your program, you would probably with your environment, you would probably also already set up the parameters of main in terms of the parameters that is given to the program via the command line or anything. This is just abstracted away here, but you could just insert that here. Apart from that, you would then provide labels for all the functions that are defined in a program for F1 to Fn, and implement code generations for them, starting with the first free register index 1, because 0 is reserved to be the return value of the of the function already. So 1 is just the first free thing, and you would use as the environment for the variables, there's this standard file which just would contain all the mappings from the names to the labels here. So this is probably the only thing that is in there, since we have no global variables at this point, and we combine that with the environments for each of the functions themselves. But that is again a thing that is usually done by the simple table visitor anyway. Yeah, I'm not so sure whether this is good way that is written down there, with the row being the empty set and row evaluating to that. I think that doesn't fit together, but anyway. this is the address of the local variables per function. Okay, good. Yeah, so all in all, if you put that together, we can have a look at how the translation for the factorial function looks like. So this is kind of everything in one thing. So this is kind of the masterpiece of code generation for our purposes, at least. So let's have a look at that. So there is the one function there. Immediately, there's no main function defined, so anyway, there's the declaration of the function fuck, so this goes at the label for fuck. It starts with the usual saving of the parameters, so we move the first parameter into the first local variable. Apart from that, there is just no other local variable defined in the body of the whole of this thing. Instead, there is a condition of a branching statement first. So this is what we have to make sure to translate, which is done here. So first we move the value from the parameter into a well-known register R2, then prepare the constant for the whole thing to be compared against in R3, do the less or equal test, and then jump according to the result of that to label underscore A like this, or fall through depending on what happens there. So in the case that the thing is less or equal, we will just fall through and continue with what is found there, this return one thing. So this is what goes here. Return one is simply translated into loading of constant one, moving that to our well-known place R0, and then perform the actual return. So afterwards, then, in the structure of if then else, we would have to jump to the end of the if statement. So this is why you have this last instruction over here. But since this is preceded by the return statement, this is unreachable code. So this actually doesn't really matter what is there. Instead, what else is reachable is what we find at label A, which is the code for the else branch. So this is this part of the program. So what happens here? Well, there's a return of an expression, so we have to evaluate the expression, which starts with, well, the innermost thing that we need to take care of is probably the x minus 1. So this is realized by the... This first of all, this is the other innermost part. So these are both leaves of this tree. So there's the x itself, which we have to multiply to everything. So this is going into this first part. R1 is moved into R2. Then we have to do the second part. For that, we have to go to the innermost to the leaves in order to start evaluating. So this is this x minus 1. There's again an x, so we copy value from R1 to R3, prepare the constant that is to be subtracted in the instruction there. So then we have covered the x minus 1. Then what we obtained from there is going into another call to the factorial. So what we need to do now is we need to move the parameter into the according parameter register. So we move from R3 to R minus 1. We also have to evaluate the expression for the actual call, which is just a constant here. So this is this underscore fuck moved into R3, where it resides while we decide to perform the actual saving of the registers. Perform the method call with a mark and call, wait until the execution returns before we then restart execution with a restore lock of R1 and R2. We move the result from R0 to R3, and then we can finally perform the actual multiplication of whatever we have returned from the function, and the quite early on provided other factor of the multiplication, so this is R2 and R3, they go into the multiplication and provide us with a result value of stored in R2, which we will then move into R0 as our resulting value, and then perform the actual return, because we have the return statement in there. And this fellow over here, this second return, is actually also is it a dead one? Where does this underscore b? This was this is also dead, because the underscore b was the one that originated from the jump underscore b, and this is dead, so this one is also a dead one, and it comes from the return that is created in the cogeneration scheme for complete functions anyway, in case that there is no explicit return mentioned in there. So this is how a complete translation looks like, and with that we have reached the end of what we want to show you here in this lecture. If you're interested in how the matter of translating goes on, there is always a few lectures that continue from the point where we leave here now. There's, for once, the virtual machines, usually read in the summer semester. You have missed that if you are not in this lecture right now. This is about more of the stuff that we have seen in the today and last week. So this is about cogeneration schemes for different language concepts, not only procedural language that we have seen here. So it's about C, of course, but it's also about how to translate functional languages with some kind of mini ML-like language. There is translation of logical programs, a subset of Prolog in that sense, and object-oriented languages, parallel constructs, and all that. And it goes a lot more into detail than the things that we have seen here. For example, we have left out everything that has to do with heap, with structures, with address of and pointers and all that. So this is what is done in this virtual machines lecture. Then there's also the program optimization lecture, which directly starts from code that could have been produced by the schemes that we have here. So this is taking off from the level of this kind of intermediate code, and the goal is to rearrange and rewrite the sequences of code that come out of such a translation, such that a lot of the redundancies that are found in these naive cogeneration system, naive cogeneration schemes, are coming with them. Those will go away with the optimizations that you see there. Then there's also a few matters that are not covered by the virtual machines and the compiler construction itself, like more exotic program paradigms, and those are the topic of the programming languages lecture in winter semester, and there's a lot of different things like memory models that define the core semantics of what memory accesses actually really are, particularly in times of concurrent architectures and transactional memory and all that funky stuff. There's a lot of things that you have to keep in mind when you do actual code generation. Then there's concepts that go beyond the usual single inheritance that you know from virtual machines, like multiple inheritance and traits and all these more and prototype-oriented programming, which are all things that are not really covered in virtual machines or this one here. So they also go into programming languages. There's also a lab course in program optimization next semester, which will comprise working with the LLVM toolkit, particularly developing a few algorithms for the innards of a compiler, particularly analysis and transformation of code that is on the level of this intermediate code that we see here indicated. So this is what this practical course is about, and then there is the seminar on innovative programming models and code generation, which also has topics in the or recent topics in this career. So if you're interested in that, you might also consider this one. Okay, so I think that's all from my side. I hope you found this thing a little bit informative and have learned a little bit from that. Apart from that, I wish you good luck in your exam and hopefully see you soon.